time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, no pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later as if at all.
Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. on WGXC at 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. This month's show is a bit different from most. It's going to be my last one for a wee while. I'm taking some time off to work on my own projects. Meanwhile, I'll be handing over the reins to the well-known journalist Paul Smart. I'll be playing some clips from recent shows. Paul and I are going to chat a bit about what's coming up. And there's his interview with the fine art photographer Charisse Isis, who has an exhibition called Grace, a series of portraits of breast cancer survivors at the Green County Council on the Arts Gallery. One of the qualities all of my guests have is passion. British artist William Blake said, "To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." But photographer Art Murphy sees the world in fossils.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that really struck me about the fossils and this tremendous arc of time is how it seems to me it's almost kind of a spiritual thing, in that it really kind of gives us a perspective on this life, very similar to my love of astronomy. You know, you go out on a clear night and you look at the stars and you try to comprehend the vastness of the universe, and it does kind of put things in perspective for you. Similarly, as you look back in time, going all the way out in the further reaches of the universe, you're going back to time frames that are not too different in many ways from when these fossils were around. Kind of helps when the day-to-day stuff can get a little bit under your skin. You know, you can just say, well, this isn't even a blip. And it just kind of helps you to ride through whatever kind of malady you're having to contend with on any given day.
Now, you exhibit, you do this for yourself, or do you make...
Well, I do care to share it as an artist, of course. I've got shows coming up, which are really exciting. Really, the most exciting thing right now is that I'm scheduled for a solo show at the Museum of Natural History in Florence, Italy, in September.
How did they find you?
Well, let me just say, first of all, I get goosebumps every time I say that. I
mean, yes.
This is the home of Leonardo. And there's actually been some healthy speculation that some of the pieces that are in the collection that I photographed in Florence might very well have come from his own hands. So, you know, it doesn't get much better than that. How it happened was my partner Cindy and I were on a trip, I guess it's almost 2 years ago, to Italy. And one of the things that I've learned to do over the course of time, before we go anywhere, whether it's, down the street, over to the next county or another country, I like to prep a little bit. The worst thing in the world to have happen is to come back from a trip and go, oh my God, there was something really cool there and I missed it. So of course I Google right away, you know, where I'm going, and start to look into fossils and such, and see if there's something to make additionally out of the trip. In that particular case, I had discovered that the Natural History Museum of Florence had a geologist and paleontologist running that division. And since we were going to be in Florence for a week, I contacted them in advance, sent them some of the articles that had been written on me and my website and the like, and said I would love to have the opportunity to just introduce myself and say, hello, might you have the time? And I met with them, and they were just the sweetest, loveliest, most delightful people. In fact, I find that often with the people who I meet, various geologists and paleontologists, who get off on what I'm doing because they've never seen anything like it. And we strike up a very nice rapport. I was always unsure how they would react to it because these are not specimen type images. You know, I take liberties. They took us on a tour of the back rooms, where, of course, that's where all the cool stuff goes on at museums, all the stuff that's hidden away.
Well, that's good to know.
Well, many of, particularly with fossils and things like that, the collections serve a greater purpose for research than anything else. And some fine collections may have millions of pieces, but most of the time they're going to sit in the drawers. Seldom do they get any sort of square footage on the museum floor because the museum floors are usually taken up with sexier stuff, you know, like tyrannosauruses and, you know, vertebrate animals. So it's a real treat to get behind the scenes and look in the drawers and poke around. Anyway, we had a lovely meeting there. They showed me around, and at the end of it, I just really couldn't contain myself. And I said, might it be at all possible just to take a few pictures? Stefano, the paleontologist there, said, well, come back tomorrow and we'll set something up for you. Had no idea what that would mean. I got there at 9:30, like he requested, and said to him, you will have to throw me out because I will use up every available second that you're going to give me. So please tell me up front, how much time do I have? And thank you again. And he looked at his watch and said, well, I'm going to be here all day, so you got till 4:30. And I proceeded to photograph as much of their collection as I could in that period of time. And when I was done, as we were saying our goodbyes, they said, you know, we would really love to see the work. We might be able to work out a show. I was just beside myself. And whether or not it was going to happen was almost immaterial because it was the gesture that was so sweet. Over time, and it took a while, and I got word, I guess it was in December, that they got a date for the show, and they're excited, and I'm more than excited. In fact, one of the coolest parts of it is that they really understood what it is that I try to do with my work, and they want to do something with it similar, and that is, as a photographer, you focus on different things that really kind of pique your interest. And hopefully there's a certain universality to that, that, you know, if you think it's kind of cool, then there's a reason why other people might want to take a look at it. And there's so much about our existence and about life with these old objects or these former beings, if you will, from this long ago period, that people just walk by and have no sense of it all, that if they were to stop and take a look at the picture and say, whoa, how cool is that? Maybe that'll spark a little bit of an interest to just explore just another little aspect of the world around them. May not even be fossils, but just, you know, just opening up minds and eyes and awareness. And they feel the very same way, so much so that part of my exhibit in Florence will also be that they're opening up the back rooms that have never had people, you know, it's never been open to the public because they want to hopefully use my photographs as a springboard to turn visitors to the museum on to how beautiful some of this stuff is.
So what's in the back rooms then?
Oh, just endless rows of cabinets, glass cabinets filled with fossils from all over the world.
So it's a fossil fest. A fossil fest in Florence, sorry.
Well, in fact, the joke that we have, we Cindy and I had come to Florence from Rome, where we spent just a few days, and it was the first time I had seen the Sistine Chapel. And just the overwhelming power and beauty of it had me in tears. It was so wonderful. And here we are a week later in Florence, and they throw open the door to this back room it looks exactly like you would imagine it, you know, 18th century cabinets, you know, spindly wood and glass. And when And when Elisabetta opened up the door, I just kind of gasped and I said, my God, this must be the Sistine Chapel of Fossils. I think I was in from that point on. Yeah. And they loved it. And we, you know, we struck a chord. So it's been going well ever since.
Brian Petty is a supremely talented playwright and writer, and he's also a very kind and generous teacher of his craft. Here he is reading a chapter from his blog, Sister Mercedes and the Temple of Doom.
I'll start with the very first one. It's called Sister Mercedes and the Temple of Doom. You can wonder where I got that title from.
Yes, where did you get that title from?
Well, Sister Mercedes was actually my principal when I was that fat Irish-Italian kid that you spoke of. This happened in the seventh grade. It was a huge part of my Catholic upbringing, I guess you could say. That, I think that pretty much sets us up for where we are. I had a college professor who once said, Catholicism gives you something infinitely complex to rebel against for the rest of your life. Being a rebellious Catholic, I said to myself, what the hell does he know? Notice I didn't say it out loud. But as I look back at my 12 years of Catholic school, I have to say he had a point. No one taught me the true meaning of wretched, bilious hate better than nuns. In the 1970s, there were two reasons to become a nun: morbid fear of sex and latent lesbianism. I mean, if you didn't get laid during the summer of 69, what chance did you really have thereafter? I suppose there were some authentic brides of Christ, but in 12 years, I met precious few. Certainly not my principal, Sister Mercedes. That was her name, I swear. She hated me. A little background. I wasn't a troublemaker. Quite the contrary, I was boringly, stupefyingly good. Good grades, never caused trouble, barely spoke, actually. My younger brother, however, was an absolute hellion in gray uniform pants and a maroon sweater. A classmate of his was running full out to line up after recess, and my brother casually stuck out his foot and tripped her. Sister Jean saw this and responded as any reasonable adult in a position of authority would. She beat the hell out of him. A closed-fist, old-school, mass-in-Latin massacre. Amen, alleluia. My mother's cousin lost a promising high school basketball career in the 50s because a nun broke a yardstick over his calf. he was asked what he had done to provoke the poor woman. But the 70s were a more civilized, groovy decade. Nothing was bad enough to warrant an attack on a mere child, even though the poor girl did go sprawling headlong on the concrete parking lot, and by all reports, my brother laughed his ass off while she did. My father was not going to kowtow to the Catholic hierarchy, especially post-Vatican II. He went to Sister Mercedes and demanded that Sister Jean apologize to my brother, which she did, tearfully, in front of my brother's class. Sister Mercedes, like John Gotti or Tony Soprano, never forgot that humiliation and dishonor. She needed a scapegoat, or in more appropriate religious doctrine, a sacrificial lamb. Enter a fat, sensitive, seventh grader with pants slightly lighter shade of gray than everyone else's. We had to find them in the husky section, often in corduroy. And enter the Hobbit. I loved the Hobbit. I was one of those nerdy kids who actually enjoyed reading on his own. The Hobbit had it all. Dragons, dwarfs, elves, short creatures with hairy feet, a magic ring, no mystical pseudo-Christian axe to grind. I'm talking to you, Prince of Narnia. The fat kid with the ripped pant crotch was entranced. Christmas break ended and we were scheduled to take our Hobbit test. I was actually looking forward to it. The tests were passed out along with our Scantron answer sheets. No sooner had I raised my number 2 pencil than all the tests were immediately recollected, and we were asked to take out a piece of loose leaf numbered 1 to 10. We were then given 10 short answer questions, roughly along the lines of, what was Bilbo's second cousin's dog's name, and on what page did he appear in the standard Penguin edition? 2 of my classmates, apparently, had stolen the answer key out of the teacher's cabinet and distributed it to every kid in the class except me. Such was my anonymity among my peers. One of the pilferers came from a family of 19 children that had such a squeaky reputation that nuns and priests would frequently genuflect in the presence of their mother. She barely noticed, busy as she was trying to avoid tripping over her own uterus. But I digress. The fuzz had caught on. The nuns had played the old switcheroo game with our tests, and waiting in the hallway to extract information from the defendants was Sister Mercedes. Within minutes, she had the kid from the big family awash in tears of guilt and announced to the class that because of his larceny, none of us would be having recess for a month, unless we had passed the 10-question sham test. Nobody did. I was the closest with 6 correct. While we were sitting inside during recess, relegated to whispered conversation, an idea occurred to me that I should have dismissed immediately and without any further internal discussion. The idea was, this is unfair. I know, right? Stupid, naive fatty. I tested the idea with my fellow classmates and found 100% agreement. Emboldened, I timidly ventured that someone should bring said unfairness to someone's attention. This time I was soundly congratulated not only for my otherworldly perceptive abilities, but also for possessing the courage, nay, the hubris, to attempt such discussion with so formidable an antagonist as Sister Mercedes. Excuse me, what? I was volunteered by popular demand. In short work, I had become their voice, their hope, their backbone, their unwitting fool. I sucked in my substantial stomach and asked my teacher if I could speak to Sister Mercedes. The dear woman tried to talk me out of it, but I was single-minded in my determination to slit my own wrists. I marched into the school office, waited courteously behind a mother who was signing her kid out sick, while my heart pounded in my chest, and found myself face to face with destiny. In between my stammer and spittle, I think I managed to squeak out that I thought group punishment was unfair. Sister Mercedes' eyes narrowed and, I think, turned red. She cocked her habit at a jaunty angle to her white hair. And what makes you so special, Mr. Petty, that you think you deserve to go outside and play while all your friends stay inside? No, there were others. I'm their champion. I'm their hero. They practically nominated me Pope just now in that classroom. How dare you try to sully so pure a comradeship as I have with my fellow classmates? I was practically carried into this office on the wings of companionship and civic pride. So steeled in the adoration of my fellow man, I replied approximately, I never spoke so eloquently. Get back to your classroom immediately. I'll be up in a minute. As soon as she entered the room, she demanded that I stand up. Mr. Petty thinks his punishment is unfair. He thinks he should be allowed to go out and play while the rest of you stay here in your classroom. Do any of you feel the same way? Cue crickets. I thought so. Do you know what that makes you, Mr. Petty? A parasite. Do you know what that means? A person who's taking a vow of poverty yet lives quite comfortably on the money squeezed out of her lower middle class congregation when the plate is passed every Sunday, is what I should have said. No, was my actual reply. You should look it up, Mr. Petty. It perfectly describes you. And here I am years later on disability. I guess she had me nailed. But I learned some important lessons, character building lessons that followed me throughout my life. Lessons like might is right, power is meant to be exploited, and fairness is a relative concept. And most importantly, if you plan on taking a stand on moral grounds, don't look over your shoulder. You're better off not knowing how few folks are back there.
Sometimes we know, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we give, sometimes we won't. Sometimes we're strong, sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we cry. Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough. Yeah, we look in the mirror and we want to give up. Sometimes we don't even think we'll try. Sometimes we cry. Well, we're gonna have to sit down and think it right through. If we're only human, what more can we do? The only thing to do is eat humble pie. Sometimes we cry. Or they put me in a jacket, if they take me away, I'm not gonna fake it like Johnny Ray. Sometimes we live, sometimes we die, sometimes we cry. Sometimes we die, sometimes we cry.
One of my favourite interviewees was the 92-year-old Greene County working artist and teacher, Stanley Maltzman. Here he is explaining what he does.
Plein air is a saying that's been around for a while. And what it means is that I did most of my work outdoors. And it's wonderful to do that because you smell and you feel and sense the beauty around you. Until I guess you get to hit 92 and you're not too comfortable outdoors anymore. So I go out sketching and I make sketches in watercolor or pastel quick drawings, and I go back to my studio and I enlarge on them. And I find that very comfortable today. So that's the difference between the plein air and I'm now indoors.
So what's a typical day for you? Do you get up and paint or draw every single day?
I try to, but of course, living by myself here, I have to do some vacuum cleaning, you know, so, and the dusting a bit too. But I usually end up in the studio in the afternoon, if not right in the morning, and I do some sketching or work on some notes to work on a big, large picture. I do drawings. I love to draw. I feel drawing's the essence of all good art, and you should keep drawing. And then you find that your painting will improve because you really draw with a brush as well as with a pencil or charcoal. So I don't give up the drawing, but I paint and I do a lot of pastel. I'm a member of the Pastel Society of America, academic artists and Audubon artists. And it's just fun. I enter a lot of shows and you win some and you lose some.
Is it possible to put a number on how many paintings or drawings you've produced in your lifetime?
No, I don't think so, because in the beginning I never really kept accurate works, you know, how many I did or what. I did them because I love to do them, and I still do it, but now I make a little postcard on everything I do frame. So I have quite a few. You know, you don't sell everything you do. And your studio soon gets crowded, and people like to come in there. They wiggle around because they can't walk straight, and they love to dig in and find things. And I enjoy it, too. I don't mind. I have a lot of wonderful friends I met through my art, and I still have many of them. They don't live here anymore. They live out in Arizona and Darien and Colorado, all over. And it's nice to get letters from people that they saw my work here and there and so forth. So don't be discouraged if you don't sell something right away. You know, keep working. It's a lot of fun.
With that bit of advice, one of the things about you is that you still teach, right? In fact, you're teaching a class tonight.
Yeah, I love to teach, and I have met a lot of wonderful people with my teaching. And I do workshops. I got a workshop I'm going to do in Old Forge on July 7th for 3-4 days. I'm going to the library in Greenville, and that's free to people. But you have to sign up quick because it fills up mighty fast. As a matter of fact, that's filled class. I'm teaching that starting tonight and goes through till next week, till Wednesday, before I have a little surgery on my eyes so I can see you better.
In fact, you're having cataract surgery. And after that, I can't even imagine what your painting is going to be like, as you will kind of have new eyes.
Well, that's what I hear. You can see a lot of colors better and be able to see everything better. And that's wonderful, because right now it's a little cloudy and it's hard to read and hard to see a little bit. But I hear it's a wonderful thing and I'm looking forward to it. Right. And the VA takes good care of me. Mm-hmm.
Things I love about you, Stanley, I've only known you a very short time. I just met you a few weeks ago. But one of the things that I noticed right away is that you have this great sense of humor. And I love the voice message on your answering machine, which I want you to just relay it now.
Well, it just came to me. Instead of just saying, here I am, Stanley Maltzman, leave a message, talk to you. So I came up with this I'm Michelangelo, and I'm working on the ceiling, and it's taking longer than I thought it would, so I can't talk to you right now, but if you leave the message, I will get back to you. And it seems to work. People get a kick out of it. And, I like to keep things light if I can.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that that must keep you young. I mean, I don't want to ask the old cliched question, but it looks like I'm going to. What's your secret of longevity? What is it that keeps you young?
I don't know. They're only numbers as far as I'm concerned. And I don't worry about it. I just keep doing what I've been doing all these years and not worry about how old I'm getting. And I think that's the main thing is if I'm ill or something, I know I'm going to get over it, or I'm confident that I'm going to get over it. And I don't worry about things. As I say, to me, they're only numbers. And I keep going. And I'm enjoying life, and I'm grateful for what I got, grateful for my family, and I'm having fun.
And my last guest needs little in the way of introduction. It's multimedia artist Brian Dewan. But how did you expand your artistic repertoire? How did you get involved, for example, in the American folk song? What is it about that fascinates you?
Well, it wouldn't be limited to the American folk song other than because I can only understand English. That limits it. And of course, a lot of American folk music has its roots in Irish or English or Scottish music or other parts of the English-speaking world. So that's what it really amounts to, although most of the stuff that I end up doing is American. Also, I'm interested in things that are kind of outside of... Well, now we're so used to what people refer to as mass culture, or something that popular culture only happens at the scale of mass production. And even in the era of mass production, there still are, you know, people making songs or creating things that are outside of the world of what can normally be published or put out or has currency in the larger culture. So I like a lot of those kind of slivers that fall between the cracks, and they don't even have to be that. There's so many wonderful things that are very famous, maybe that people are tired of and think of as cliched, and yet that's not an attribute of the song or the thing. It's just that people are tired of hearing it too much. So it's interesting when something that you've already, or you're already used to thinking as being something hackneyed or a cliche or something like that, that you may be surprised if you see it with new eyes and see what it's really made of. So some things are very durable in that way. And also things that go back into history or go back beyond our own time or our own lived experience. And I've for so many years been used to presenting, you know, folk material or old popular songs or any of this type of stuff. And people don't believe that it is old or that it is historical or from the period I said it was from, because it doesn't fit in with their idea of what people were supposed to think or feel. And they say, well, you changed all the words, right? And I say, no, I didn't change any of the words. And in fact, I did not change them. And I'm just starting on a new one that's called Sit, Stare, and Rock. That's the title track. And that one, that's a song from around 1950. And it's about the pleasures of sitting in a rocking chair and doing nothing.
What are you working on? I mean, it seems that you're working on all these different things. Well,
these are things done over the years. So sometimes I'll concentrate more on one than another or not do something for a while. I haven't written songs in a few years. But, you know, there's a whole batch of stuff that I wrote that I never recorded that I will record when I'm done with the Sit, Stare, and Rock record. So that's the project that's kind of next on my agenda after getting these other sculpture things done in time for some openings and some performances down in New York that I'll get ready for. This thing called the Accordion Summit that William Schimmel sponsors. It's something at the Tenry Center, which is near the New School. And that's something I do every year. That's always a fun thing to do because there's such a wide variety of things that are performed, but the common thread is the accordion. But it's all over the place with, you know, classical pieces and avant-garde things or traditional folk or pop or performance art or some whacked out thing. So there's, you know, it's a variety show.
What are your current passions, if you like?
Well, if I'm listening to music, mostly what I'm listening to is either Renaissance music or medieval music, and also, you know, organ music. Sometimes earlier organ music. I do have a passion for modern organ music. Well, what was really a big influence on me was a French composer who's not that well known, named Jean Alain, that my father used to play. My father loved his stuff. He didn't live to be very long, but he wrote a lot of really interesting music. And it's kind of a, you know, it was written in the 20s and 30s. Harmonically, it's very modernist, but it's still kind of more in the romantic tradition. So it's an interesting kind of tonal music that's kind of way out and also often has religious overtones, but is, you know, kind of far out harmonically. And he was an enormous influence. But I haven't really been listening to stuff like that so much lately. Mostly just older music, and then sometimes just rummaging around, seeing what I can find in records, or now that there's YouTube, sometimes finding songs that I haven't heard before and stumbling into them.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're here with Brian Dewan. And we're actually sitting in his charming house in Catskill. And one can't help but notice that you're something of a collector as well, Brian. You've got rather a lot of musical instruments and all sorts of other things that I can't even contemplate describing. So what exactly is all that out there?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's a few organs. There are rotating speakers. There are zithers. And a zither is really any kind of a instrument that has a lot of open strings that you pluck, and some of the ones I have a lot of strings. The electric one is the biggest one. That one has 88 strings. Auto harps have 36 strings. Then there's some other in-between ones that you can see leaning against each other in the corner there. There's a kit harpsichord that somebody put together in the 60s that I got from somebody who didn't sell it in a yard sale and had to sell a house that had been in a garage for many years. So there's a lot of things that I've ended up with. I mean, a lot of things that were being thrown out. I don't think you can see it from here, but there's something called a Hammond Solo Vox that somebody was throwing out. A Wurlitzer electric piano, which somebody was going to get rid of. There was a time when a lot of these instruments were considered obsolete, and not just because they were heavy and that there were lighter things that you could tote to gigs, but because they were considered old-fashioned and therefore an embarrassment. Now they're valuable because they've become antiques. So it is funny always to watch as history progresses, how it people perceive the same thing differently, whether it's valued. And that's such a common cycle. Something is new and it's valued, and then it's old and it's people hold it in contempt, and then it gets older and then it is worshipped.
Right, that's what you were saying earlier about some of the American songs. And
yeah, and even the attitude towards, you know, medieval music for a long time was, you know, people in conservatories weren't interested in it, and it was considered a, you know, a primitive artifact, but that was not really of interest musically, and was or was a curiosity. But I think a lot of people looked down on it, and that's very different than today's attitude about it. But that wasn't even that long ago. So, you know, it's always different. Just keep the ears rolling and you'll have a different landscape.
I'm going to leave you with a conversation between Paul Smart and myself. Paul, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is a really terrific journalist, and I'm very lucky he's agreed to take over Thrummy for the next few months. And after that, there's his interview with the fine arts photographer Charisse Isis.
And what are you asking me to do?
Oh, Paul, well, since you brought it up, I'm going to take a wee hiatus for a few months to work on my own projects. The lovely Mr. Paul Smart has agreed to be the lovely guest host for a few months.
You can't see this, but my arm's being twisted. Twisted horribly behind my back.
If you don't shut up, darling, your neck will be twisted. Twisted horribly.
Is the name of this show? Tell me about it. This has been on since the radio began.
Yes, 100 years ago. It's called Between the Lines. I've been doing this for 2.5 years now. And the idea was that I could be this full Terry Gross interviewer type person. And Terry has got this fabulous show. I think she's one of the most astute interviewers I have ever had. I really admire her interviewing style. And I always thought if I could bring a little bit of that, I like her sincerity and her depth. She is extremely knowledgeable. So I set it my goal to swat up as much as possible on whoever was going to come on and to just try and bring out something that wouldn't normally be apparent or that wouldn't, or just to kind of get to the bottom of their souls.
And how have you found your subjects? Has it been kind of wide-ranging? I'm just trying to get a sense of direction on how to tend this garden while you're away.
It's basically I've been following my own interests, but then broaden them depending on the person. If the person had something coming out that was interesting, if they had passion. I've interviewed everybody from the 92-year-old Stanley Maltzman, who was an absolute delight. I went to interview him. He's a local, very well-known painter. I interviewed him at his studio. He lives alone, and he's one of the most charming men I have ever met. And so that was fun. So it was from all ages to different kinds of subjects. So I do tend to stay in the kind of artistic fields.
How do I get this accent?
Hours of practice, believe me, Paul. You were just beginning. After me, repeat after me. Hours, hours.
Hours. Do I have to drink a lot of scotch?
Absolutely. Hours. In fact, I've just got a bottle here. Now, funny you should mention that.
Ha, I thought there was a trick to this. Well, I can't wait to start. And I think we'll begin this month with this new show at the Greene County Council for the Arts on, it's a difficult subject, but it's... cancer, but it's taking from the idea of the journeys that we take going through illness, and both the curator of the show, the person who came up with the idea, and the solo artist upstairs, Charisse Isis, both have a lot to say, and I've talked to them before, and I think I'll bring in an interview.
When I read about it, I felt an emotional connection. Of course, because I am a breast cancer survivor, so I have been through a lot of what these women who are the subject of this exhibition have been through, though not a mastectomy. To have that kind of emotional connection is so important. And it's kind of what I look for in subjects also.
That's what, yeah, I've always found there's a way of... There are ways of pulling that out of any
Absolutely.
Subject matter, finding where the where that root is that connects them, and often it's asking us. I find it's asking a surprise question about when they were very young or growing up, or something unexpected. It's kind of opening oneself to the flow of it and figuring where that person's coming from. Oh, this will be exciting.
This will be exciting. I just try and get people to tell stories.
I
just want them to tell me the story of their life, and everybody always opens.
This will be great, and hopefully it'll be a well-tended garden by the time you come back to it in a few
If
months.
No weeds, please.
Yeah, or if they're weeds, they'll be beautiful
they'll
weeds.
Be, yes, thistles. You leave my thistles alone,
yes.
All right?
Okay.
Okay,
we'll
Paul.
We'll see you in a few
okay,
months.
Okay, absolutely.
There's an effective new show up at the Greene County Council for the Arts Catskill Gallery. Cancer Journeys, Expressions of Hope and Transformation was put together by local curator and artist Laura Garamond in reaction to some discoveries that she made while undergoing cancer treatments a few years ago. We did an interview with her about the genesis of this new exhibit, which will be up through November 2nd of this year. Unfortunately, it didn't take. We did talk to Charisse Isis, the Kingston-based photographer, Garamond, talking about what drew her to the Arts Council to do this new show, said, "It is my thought that creating art is in some way connected to and occasionally healing to the unconscious mind and psyche. Through symbolism and understanding, we can decipher what is happening inside us." She also quotes Dr. Bernie Siegel, who has proved quite helpful in her own recovery. According to Siegel, somatically, the pictures we use may point to events in the past relevant to anamnesis, or recall, early diagnosis and prognosis. Psychologically, we may see what goes on and has been going on deep in the mind, for instance, past traumas, and how the drawing can help he or she express his or her hopes, fear, and foreboding. Moreover, these pictures can build a bridge between doctor and patient, the family, and the surrounding world. We may ask how it could be that spontaneous pictures reflect, as dreams do, the total situation of the human person. I have come to see in decades of clinical work that through imagery of spontaneous pictures and of dreams, something shines through, which I have called inner knowingness.
I called it Grace because it sort of has, in its origins, it has sort of like these ancient Latin, Greek roots, which actually means, if you go to the root of the word, it means thanks. But I, you know, these women that I'm photographing, of course, are very grateful that they're surviving cancer. So on that level, it's about thanks. But on the other level, it's also referring to the grace of the body, because this project is very much about the body, and I'm photographing these beautiful, graceful bodies.
And what was the genesis of this project? How did you end up here?
I was photographing. I was doing boudoir portraits, and for money. And I had a woman who called me for a boudoir project, for a boudoir portrait. Actually, it was her husband who called me, and he really wanted his wife to do it because he'd seen an article in the Poughkeepsie Journal about my boudoir photography and how it helped women's self-esteem. And so he bought his wife a portrait session for Valentine's Day. And she showed up on her own without him, been shooting her for a while, and she got very comfortable. She was very determined to be covered through the whole shoot. And after a while, she told me that she confessed to me that she was a 12-year breast cancer survivor and that she was very embarrassed about her breast and that she felt like it was deformed and ugly. And so she started then, she got comfortable after she told me that, and she started posing with her quote-unquote good breast revealed and covering up the breast that she thought was her bad breast. And she got very comfortable, and we have having a great time shooting. And after a while, she, you know, and she was a very conservative woman. And after a while, she's just like laying there having a great time. And then she just said, "Am I allowed to curse on this?"
No.
Okay, so she said, "F it. I'm doing this for myself." And she threw off her top. And it was a really amazing moment to witness. As a photographer, because I saw this person like just step off a cliff into absolute acceptance of her own body. And it was a really beautiful metamorphosis that just like happened right in front of me. Literally not 2 weeks later, another friend of mine called me, and she also had breast cancer, or she had just been diagnosed and was going in 3 days for her surgery, and she needed she wanted to have her breast photographed before it was removed. And spending time with her during that time was just very cathartic and really amazing. I mean, I saw her sort of go through so many different emotions, fear and bravery and strength. And then she came 3 weeks later, and I photographed her 3 weeks after her surgery. And she was just so light and happy to have the cancer off of her body. And so between those two experiences, they're both really moving and really touching. And I just felt like I needed to explore that more. So I decided to do the Grace Project. It is about self-acceptance. You know, the way that I've focused the images is I'm basing the images on Hellenic sculpture, because there's the Venus de Milo and the Nike of Samothrace and all these ancient Greek sculptures which we celebrate in museums around the world. And many of them have limbs missing or pieces of their face broken off or pieces of their body broken off. And yet we still see them as ultimately beautiful, possibly even more beautiful because of their delicacy and their brokenness. And so I decided that if we can see an object in that way, why can't we see a person in that way? And so what I basically did is I created a window. And so when I photograph a woman, I sort of put this into their mind. It's interesting because it really changes their concept of the way that they're seeing themselves in that moment. But I think what it also does is it makes a doorway also for the viewer, because there's something familiar in the poses and the bodies that we're looking at. You know, I think it's a subtle unconscious thing, because I'm not directly copying these sculptures, but I'm sort of being influenced by the style of them.
Is this a postmodern sort of phenomenon of looking at pieces that have broken over time as being beautiful in the way they've come down to us? I mean, has that ideal of beauty shifted? And is that something kind of political in that it reflects the times in a act of will to accept some of the limitations that have come to us and assess them in a way where we can possibly change them?
I think it's deeper than that. I think it's looking at something and realizing the delicacy of life and how precious and beautiful it is. In terms of women with breast cancer, I mean, they've proven that women that sort of become okay with their bodies have a much better survival rate. You know, there's a whole lot that we don't understand about the power of positive thinking, although I think that more we go along, like doctors and medical people are starting to accept that thinking positively certainly does have an effect on a person's health and their healing. And the women that have been coming to my project are really in the process of accepting their bodies. Like the women that come to be photographed are like, this is my body, this is me, and I'm okay about it. And so therefore, I think that they're spreading a really beautiful positive message to other people who have had or who have the same diagnosis. I think it really it really spreads a positive message.
Does that change kind of your view of the role that art has?
Yeah, you know, I think that absolutely. I think that, art can have a healing role in the world. And I don't know, I think it's important as artists to try and help spread a positive message. Absolutely.
And that is my contribution to this month's edition of Ann Forbes Cooper's Between the Lines. I'll be back next month speaking to two authors about their works and how they've kind of helped uncover the problems that we all face with systems these days, along with some kind of modern contemporary nightmares, both in terms of health and just mindfulness. This is Between the Lines. My name is Paul Smart. I'll be hosting for Ann Forbes Cooper for the next 3 months until she's able to complete some of her great new projects, be interviewed here, hopefully, and resume this wonderful show.